Okay, thank you. Friendly introduction, and I'm very pleased that I be here again, Flying through the air, the remembrance of former existences, knowing and manipulating the thoughts and deeds of others, being insensitive to pain. All these phenomena are renowned as the powers of yogins and are usually regarded as signs of a successful practice in the various traditions of yoga. Already in the oldest texts, they are called bala, power, siddhi, achievement, or vibhuti, manifestation of might. These texts are the ancient epic Mahabharata, the Yoga Sutra, the Pashupata Sutras with the commentary of Kaundinya, and various Buddhist texts around the time between 200 BCE and 400-500 CE. I will deal with the interpretation of these powers in the Yoga Sutra a little later, and stress then the importance of a philosophical concept of nature, prakriti, in explaining how these powers work. However, first of all, I'd like to take you on a tour around various Western and academic interpretations of these powers. This discourse of Western interpretation is of interest for my arguments, since it forms the background against which nowadays any interpretation of the oldest text has to be elaborated. Although, since antique times, the figure of the yogin and his powers have inspired travelers' fantasies, a scientific investigation into their nature started only in the 19th century. Yoga and the yogin have ever since become something like a brand name of Indian culture in the West. Its emblematic and highly ambiguous character can only be compared maybe with the holy cow or the caste system. Especially the powers of the yogin became an object of mixed feelings. They were either denounced as primitive magic or admired as results of mysterious transcendence experiences. The word magic transports this ambivalence perfectly and incites followers from both camps to unearth the basis of these powers. This means to either prove the trick or the truth behind them. By the end of the 19th century, the term magic served in two new disciplines, social anthropology and the study of religion, to draw a line of demarcation between rationality and irrationality, primitive and true religion. Magic indicates a border zone wherein scientific methods were of limited use or even deemed to be impossible to use. However, one did not stop trying. Two traditions of the interpretation of magic had a direct impact on Indological studies of yoga and the Yoga Sutra. In most cases, these approaches were not critically reflected, but applied to the phenomena as a sort of common sense understanding. The first line of interpretation, I may call this evolutionist, can be traced back to the anthropologists Fraser and Tyler, who were both proposing an evolutionary view on the variety of religions. For them, magic is a lower form of rationality and should be regarded as the most primitive stage of human thought. Thus, religion emerges only after and as overcoming magic. The second approach can be called experimental psychological and is more interested in the effects of magic practice on the adept or for the adept. Thus, another founder father of social anthropology, Malinowski, argued that the effects of magic are based on, I quote, the direct influence of emotions on the organism. Research in the so-called altered states of consciousness, that is trance, ecstasy, and hypnosis, led to natural scientific experiments with yogins. For the experimental approach, the work of James Byrd, regarded as the discoverer of hypnotism, was seminal. His 1850s book called Observations on Trance or Human Hibernation includes reports on the marvelous powers of yogins who were capable to awake from an apparent death after more than 40 days being buried alive. Several reports of experiments with yogins conducted by British colonial administrators in India were circulating in journals and newspapers in Europe and India at the beginning, already at the beginning of the 19th century, and then almost through the 19th century. Such experiments are not just anecdotes from an early period of the Raj. Certainly also due to the persistent interest in seances and contacts with the dead, in Europe and the US at that time, yogis remained objects of academic and public interest. As a late 19th century examples of this popularity may serve the so-called Millennium or World Exhibition, which took place in Budapest in 1896. Among the exhibits were two yogis who had been directly transported or imported from India to Hungary in order to demonstrate their magic powers. The two yogis took turns to put each other into a comatose sleep, which would last for 8 to 14 days and thus could be compared to an apparent death. For the sake of the visitors of the exhibition, the sleeping or seemingly dead yogin would be exhibited in a glass coffin. However, the exhibits were at the same time under the scrutiny of a Hungarian professor of anthropology and a psychologist from Vienna. Thus, the yogis were weighted, their pulse and temperature constantly checked. However, one night, some skeptic visitors were hiding in the room with the glass coffin. After some hours, the sleeping yogi opened the casket and treated himself to milk and cake. He was exposed by the hidden observers, and for the yogis, now turned into frauds, the exhibition was over. Experiments like this do not belong to the past, especially from the 1950s onwards, when research on altered stage of consciousness became important in medical anthropology and research on possession cults. Experiments were an accepted method of research. In 1972, for instance, a couple of yogis were tested in Paris with encephalograms. The results were published, and the well-established French Indologist Jean Filiosa wrote the introduction. All the experiments showed that the extraordinary powers of the yogis were somehow connected to catatonic, trance-like states. They were, in the rather rude language of medicines, diagnosed as being brain dead, which is quite a long way from the luminous insight recorded to them in the Indian texts. Other questions, such as what such powers would mean to them, to the yogis, and what function they would have in the context of the quest for liberation, in brief, how to understand these phenomena in terms of the cultural and textual context that provide the basis of these practices, were rather not raised and addressed. As already indicated, both approaches, the evolutionist and the psychological, influenced the interpretations of the powers of yoga by historians and historians of religion alike. The two most read monographs, and one has to say, until today, the only ones available. We need some monograph on the subject. So the two monographs we have were written in the 1920s and 1930s by scholars who combined Indology with a specific view on the religious history of mankind. Both scholars were sympathetic to and even actively engaged in the fascist movements in Germany and Romania, respectively. I'm talking about Jacob Hauer, German, and Mircea Eliade. Both developed their own variation of the evolutionary interpretation of the history of religion. The influence of Hauer is less intense than that of Iliade, but the book is still quoted, and in Germany reprints are made time and again. According to Hauer, the history of yoga demonstrates the development from the lowest practices of sorcery and magic to the highest level of mysticism. The yogic powers belong, of course, to the lower levels. Iliade calls that practice, which according to the Yoga Sutra, results in the acquisition of these powers, I quote, a technique of magic assimilation. Through such a kind of magic, the yogin appropriates the object of his meditation. For Iliade, these magic elements of yoga are living fossils, quote, of archaic time. The ambiguous perception of the yogin as magician and liberated ascetic is based, for Iliade, on confused ideas of lower people. Almost 50 years later, the renowned Austrian Indologist and phenomenologist of religion, Gerhard Oberhammer, also feels that the Siddhi Yoga, that is that part of the Yoga Sutra dealing with the powers of the yogin, needs to be excluded from any serious consideration or understanding of yoga. For him, this aspect demonstrates an, quote, archaic stage in the understanding of existence, which was fortunately superseded by Buddhism and Sankhya philosophy. In the second part of my talk, I will show that the powers of yoga, of the yogin, have become an integral part of many yoga traditions, not in spite of Sankhya philosophy, but because of it. Before I go into the text, now let me, for a last time, conclude and turn back to the survey, and conclude with the influence of the psychological approach on yoga studies. The first monograph that followed this approach was published in 1933 by Lindquist. According to Lindquist, the powers are mere subjective experiences. They are, quote, self-induced hallucinations, which are caused by a series of self-suggestions in a hypnotic state, unquote. Similar statements can be found in more recent publications by Tola and Dragonetti, for example. This classification of yogic powers as altered states of consciousness is by now widely accepted, and this turns them into purely subjective experiences that have no connection with any social or other outside world. It has also influenced the study of the original Sanskrit texts and made the siddhis, the powers, a less studied field of yoga. However, in recent years, Geromino Tensa and Gordon White have launched a kind of rehabilitation of the importance of these powers in the yoga traditions, stressing the actual impact of this theme on Indian literature, and they stress also the function with regard to liberation in the Yoga Sutra. Yet, important aspects of how they are actually explained in the Yoga Sutras are yet to be analyzed, and so my talk addresses now the question, what does the Yoga Sutra actually say? Why these powers arise and how do they function? The primary source for a systematic treatment of the powers of yoga, although they are mentioned in the older texts in the epic, is the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, roughly to be dated between 300 and 400 CE. In taking this text as a point of departure, I like to show that the powers of yoga are not mere remnants of archaic magic or dubious byproducts of a primarily spiritual practice, but rather that they are important for determining the status of a yogin with regard to two adjacent fields of power. These are divinity and kingship. The superior status of both gods and kings is in many texts of early Hinduism intimately connected with yogic powers. The figure of the successful yogin has influenced the concept and iconography of the highest god and of a mighty king in many early Hindu theologies. How can this be explained? I like to argue that the notions of dominance and power accorded to gods, kings and yogins in this kind of similarity at this time are based on the development of a concept of nature or creative force called Prakriti or Pradana, which was designed in this way at the very same time. Nature, Prakriti, is the very field in which all three, gods, kings and yogins, gain and use their powers. This concept emerged almost certainly simultaneously, that is, around the beginning of the Common Era. The concept of Prakriti is present in the earliest systematic treatises on yoga in the epic and Upanishadic texts and was later systematized in the philosophical school of Sankhya, especially in the Sankhya Karika of Ishvara Krishna. The form of Sankhya taught in this text is almost identical with the Sankhya terminology used in the Yoga Sutra. Both texts are thus the result of a certain systematization of both types of thinking and practice. Both texts, in turn, differ from the majority of the epic sources in that they use the term Prakriti, and this is not important, in the singular. Whereas in the epic philosophical text, we hear of 7 or 8 Prakritis that cooperate and have to be coordinated in order to create the physical world. The emergence of the idea of Prakriti as a singular common cause, the one and only nature and material of creation, did allow to deal with yogic powers in a new perspective, since it opened up the possibility to connect a yogin to nature as a whole cause and a unique cause of all creative activities. And it allowed yoga to be embedded in the cosmological and physiological cognitive framework of the Sankhya school. On the basis of this new unified concept of Prakriti, the powers of the yogin can be regarded as resulting from a series of conquests of the different stages of the evolution of nature, starting bottom up with the sense objects and the senses, the 5 elements, ending in the end in what is called in Yoga Sutra 345, the conquest of nature, Pradana Jaya. Let me now turn to the Yoga Sutra in order to put this into more concrete terms. The explanations of the powers of yoga can be found in those parts of the sutra that deal actually with the siddhi, which is a major part of the 2nd chapter, and the whole 3rd chapter of the Yoga Sutra are dedicated to this topic. The siddhis are presented in these chapters as resulting from the practice of the last 3 steps of the Eightfold Yoga practice, the so-called Ashtanga Yoga, regarded by many scholars as Patanjali's core teaching, maybe even his invention. For these 3 final stages or parts of the yoga technique, a special term is coined which indicates their interconnection. The final stage is the so-called samyama, which can be translated as a complete restraint. The 5 preceding parts are preliminary fields of practice. They are absolutely necessary in order to practice the rest. They comprise an ascetic lifestyle determined by the observance of 10 vows, which range from cleanliness to nonviolence and celibacy. This is followed by training in specific postures, control of breathing, and the withdrawal of the senses from the object. One has to bear in mind that these elements of yoga remain valid when the yogi starts with the other ultimate steps in his practice. This is of special importance with regard to the powers a yogin acquires. His commitment to the lower stages should prevent him from abusing the powers for undesirable purposes. The samyama consists of three consecutive steps. First, dharana, binding, fixation, which means the yogi chooses a place, such as the tip of his nose or the navel, to which the movements of his thought, the citta, as it is called in the Yoga Sutra, are tied and concentrated on. The second stage is dhyana, often translated as meditation, which means fixing consciousness on one object only. This means the movements of thought are concentrated on the meditation. This is my distinction I introduce, and they are concentrated on the meditation. It's not meditation, but concentration on the meditation, which means concentration on the mental construction of the object of meditation. Now, dhyana is a process in which the object is actually created mentally. These objects can range from the elements like fire or water to the sun, moon, etc. The aim is to stop all discursive thoughts or subjective associations the yogi might have stored in his mind in relation to this object. The third stage is then samadhi, often translated as contemplation. Actually, as defined in the Yoga Sutra, it is the appearance of the created object in its own form. No longer do the movements of consciousness determine the presence of the object. No longer the object creates its meditational alter ego. Rather, the object has expanded in the mind of the adept. The object has actually taken over thinking. Yeah. So it's a kind of reversal. Patanjali calls this stage Artamatra Nirvasa, the manifestation or shining forth of the object only, Yoga Sutra 3.3. This stage can be described as the reversal of the original relationship between subject and object, a reversal which is important for understanding the powers of yoga. Consciousness does no longer produce ideas and thereby remains in charge of its own processes of construction. Rather, the object factually enters and fills up consciousness, which is now in a state in which its natural activity, that is its construction of the object, what is usually done, has stopped. The consciousness citta is now transformed by its object, and this is when it gains access to the specific powers or the realm of activity which is ascribed to this object of meditation. So the activity accorded to this object which enters the mind has to be kept in mind in order to understand what is meant here with this empowerment of the yogi by the very object which enters the mind. Consequently, this stage of practice is defined in the oldest extant commentary of the Yoga Sutra by Vyasa as Gyeya Svabhava Avesha. I think I'm so, Avesha, the point. Avesha means this process of entering. I have tried to describe. Sorry?
Active possession is probably attached.
No, it's actually possession. Yeah? Well, okay, I just continue. Much depends on the translation of the final member of this compound, the term avesha. Woods, one of the earliest translators of the text, for example, translates, the yogin fuses consciousness with the nature, fuses consciousness with the nature, which is svabhava, the own being, of the object to be contemplated. So I would say of the object to be construed. Yeah? According to this translation, the citta is still somehow the active part because it's the citta which fuses, yeah, itself with the object. This is, however, difficult to reconcile with other commentarial statements such as we find in the Yogavartika. Here, the specific quality of the stage is seen in the extraordinary immobility, the stopping of the movements of the mind. Another objection can be raised against the rather weak translation as of avesha as fusion, which is somehow quite a harmless thing, you just fuse and then it's fine. However, as has been shown by Minoru Hara, the word avesha is used to describe all kinds of infiltrations and experiences of overpowerment. The word is used, for example, for possession by a spirit or a ghost, as well for a state like being overwhelmed by desire. Thus, usually, avesha indicates the agency of something or someone else on another being. One is exposed to the activity, the power of something, someone else, if one has an avesha experience. Therefore, I suggest a different translation, which has a strong and a weak form. In its strong form, my translation would run, because consciousness is possessed by the very form of existence which belongs to the object of meditation. The weaker form, maybe more digestible, is because the object of meditation has entered consciousness in its own way of being, as it really is. Together with the form of existence, or in its very own form, the object of meditation has entered the consciousness, but also the specific activity and power which is characteristic of this object has entered the consciousness of the yogi. So it's no longer just that you imagine a river or water, but somehow what is actually described is that your consciousness becomes capable to have water, the power and activity of water, enter this realm and thus in a way be empowered with regard to this object. This is why yogis are able to walk on the water, because their consciousness is more encompassing, yeah, is filled up by this very object, and this, yeah, transforms them, yeah, by this very being, yeah, like water. So this situation results in a transformation, as it is called in the Yoga Sutra, the transformation of consciousness as it is normally functioning. The word here for transformation is parinama, and all those of you are familiar with the huge debate between real transformation and illusion know that parinama means a real transformation. Thus, it is stressed that the effect this kind of avesha of an object into consciousness has a real impact, a real effect, it's not just an imagination. The shape and function of the citta of the mind of the yogi is transformed, and this transformation is the basis for acquiring these powers. Let me stop here for a moment and come back maybe to our perspective, and I see in your skeptical faces that this has already switched on. So recalling some Western views on such processes and doctrines, we can detect here the issue, the actual point of debate and the whole skepticism. For some scholars, this whole process of being possessed by an object like water, or even becoming identical with it, can be only in the end an imagination, however strong and convincing, a hallucination without any real basis in the material world. For others, the idea that an object that has been called into being by a mental construction would turn into something real and powerful is just the example of the archaic magical mind they have waited for. This is indeed what magicians seem to do, making something appear to be what is actually not there, playing powers which are based on tricks. Belief in magic thus means mistaking and confounding subjective ideas and images with real, objective causes and things. This is, for example, one of the reasons which already referred to Gerhard Oberhammer gives in order to exclude these sutras from the text at all. However, switching back to the discourse of the Yoga Sutra opened up with these, the object enters and transforms the consciousness of the yogi. The terms parinama, transformation, and svabhava, the own being of the object, point to the philosophical context which is elsewhere applied to the powers of yoga. This context is the concept of nature and the constitution of the body that has been developed in Sankhya philosophy and was, as I already pointed out, so just for those of you who want to recall this scheme of Sankhya, and which was accepted by the author and commentators of the sutra. The practice and this idea that an object enters consciousness, which sounds maybe a little bit strange, can be explained and understood against the background or on the basis of this Sankhya concept of nature. This concept is based on assumptions that differ from those of the modern Western idea of nature, familiar to those who happen to deal with yogic powers since the 19th century. Thus, for example, the Sankhya concept of prakriti does not operate with notions as, for example, the distinction between mechanical and organic functions in nature, or they would not separate matter or the body from cognitive functions like thoughts and desires, and so on. Rather, cognitive functions, the mind, the inner senses, as well the visible parts of the body are seen in one causal continuum because they are all regarded as products of prakriti, as you can nicely see on this chart. What evolves in the visible world is all the product of prakriti. There's only one entity, and this is very well known to you, that differs from prakriti, the so-called witness consciousness or the knower, which is entangled in the material world due to an error about his true identity as an ever-liberated being. However, since the powers of yoga deal with the realms of prakriti, the different stages, I will not deal with the purusha at this point, but focus on prakriti for some moments. As you can see on the chart, and as we can see when we look around us, according to Sankhya, all beings are products of prakriti, and this means that they share the principal characteristics of nature as their common and only cause. These characteristics are being active, self-activity, self-proliferation, productivity, and the capacity to entertain purposeful relationship between each other. So these different elements you see on this chart are in a way cooperate on the assumption that they all, each of them, they serve a purpose, a shared purpose. Our bodies are created by the powers of nature in an ordered sequence of the basic, of the manifestations of these constituents you can see on the chart that are generally identical but are different in each individual. As a consequence, each product of Prakriti is characterized by its natural activity and functionality. This is the basic point. All these levels you see, they are not, you see, solidified principles, but they are conceived of as being constantly active. Yeah? So, seen from this angle of activity, the activity of breathing and the similar constantly going on activity of saying I just testify to the same principle that they are both belonging to Prakriti, and this is the very object and a yogi has to deal with. It's not a solidified thing but an active thing. Now one more thing which hopefully explains this process of entering. What we also have to bear in mind when we try to understand this kind of how the body is produced in a sequence of stages out of Prakriti are the principles of this kind of production and emanation. First of all, it's a stepping down or a manifestation from an invisible to an visible realm. And this visibility is expressed in terms of an increase of materiality, specification. So each step on the chart, the more we come down, the denser matter becomes. And this means each principle is smaller, produced principle is smaller in size, it's very important, in size than the preceding one. So what we see here so nicely, it was coming down means to shrink in size. Yeah? To give you one example, the internal sense of hearing, for example, which you can see comes out of the ego consciousness, has its location in the visible ear, which is produced at the end of a production of the body, according to Sankhya. But our realm of hearing is not confined to the ear. The sense, the inner sense of listening, is larger, bigger than what is here, the hole in the head. You see, this is what is meant with the shrinking process. Yeah? Conversely, consciousness is the biggest, the largest, and most encompassing principle, according to Sankhya philosophy, in mere size. So, all these features, and this means if you move up this ladder of the principles, you expand again. Sometimes it's described as a process of reduction. But in fact, if you follow the principles I tried to explain before, in which each step you reach in your conquest of these powers of nature, you have an experience of expansion. And this is the Sankhya explanation of the phenomena you find in many also Buddhist texts and later Hindu texts, that in certain stages of meditation you have the experience of infinity and vastness, this kind of expansion. With the Sankhya scheme you can explain this perfectly, because actually you reach the highest, largest principle of production. Okay, so, and this explains why then an element like water, if it is controlled from the position of the highest principle consciousness, yeah, can then adequately expand in the consciousness, and the whole realm accorded with this element becomes, yeah, or enters consciousness and becomes accessible to the practitioner. Same holds true, maybe a more feasible example, or better to imagine a common power you achieve when you practice these stages of concentration on the object is, for example, that you get this kind of universal listening, that you can listen or that you can hear all the sounds, yeah, you want to hear, yeah, even in very, yeah, distant places. This can also be perfectly explained by this principle of the element of your meditation expanding in consciousness, and then the yogi can control this. Otherwise, one is exposed to the sounds which surround us. Okay, this might help to explain why one has to be careful, or why one has to qualify the notion of an object when one talks about object of meditation. Object suggests that a yogi would deal with stable, accessible things. We have a very solidified notion with object. However, given the Sankhya scheme, the yogin deals with the activity and power present at the very place on which his practice is directed. And thus, when the yogi tries at the beginning of his practice to establish a stable and fixed position, he is actually dealing with the activity that is going on in his back, in his legs, in his hands, and so on. All this has to be stopped. So he's not, in a way, dealing with the object of a leg, but with the, yeah, itching and pain which is going on there. To control the activity means to reach the next step in the hierarchy of elements, and this means to reach the course of the lower one. So, moving up this ladder of the principles of nature means the yogi experiences a process of natural empowerment, in that the powers of all the elements are now enter his consciousness. Okay. In the end, after the conquest of nature, the yogi in the Yoga Sutra, he becomes a lord, an Ishvara, as it is said. He has gained lordship, Aishvarya, and therefore he has gained power over the specific element he has entered. He has had entered his consciousness. This ascription of lordship and power indicates an intimate connection between yoga and a more general discourse on power and power positions in the early Hindu traditions. As I have tried to show, this connection between the powers and yogis, the powers and of yoga and other powers in the Hindu context, have been neglected due to the general approach to the siddhis as magical side effects or digressions from a superior meditation practice, and also because somehow these objects entering consciousness is kind of a hard thing to deal with and to take serious, perhaps. Also, time and again, the Yoga Sutra itself was quoted in support of a complete rejection of these powers. However, on a closer look, the Yoga Sutra, which is often quoted to support this view, runs, The cities are obstacles for meditation that leads to ultimate liberation. However, they are perfections, instruments, when a yogin again turns to the world. So for all those who have some business to do in the world, these powers are achievements. And this is why the discourse on the powerful yogin has somehow confounded with adjacent power, people like gods and yogis. Although it is true that the powers of yogi have to be given up when a yogi strives for final liberation, a mere wielding of power or a sojourn in the realm of nature was consequently regarded as a danger when it prevented the yogi from dealing with the ultimate goal. However, in order to leave the realm of Prakriti for good, it is necessary and even inevitable to conquer it. Therefore, the cities are a result of successful yoga practice, regardless of their being used or not. There is no way to avoid these powers. No? There is no, I don't know of any Hindu texts, and I'm happy to be proven the contrary, where it's not the liberation connected with some stage where the adept experiences a huge access to power and actually can turn back to the world. So it is somehow a necessary thing that comes. Conversely, power positions within the world came to be connected with yogic powers and measured against the figure of the yogi. In consequence, power over nature became also mandatory for gods and kings. This is why the powers of yoga are regarded as an integral part of this tradition, because a yogin, in order to qualify his being ready for liberation, has any time to be able to show, I have conquered nature. In other texts of early Hinduism, such as the Bhagavad Gita, the Manusmriti, or the Arthashastra, dealing with the politics of king, yogic power over nature are ascribed not only to yogis, but also to the highest god and kings. A famous example of the convergence of all three power positions is the description of the yoga of lordship, the yoga Aishwaram, in the Bhagavad Gita, it's the Bhagavad Gita 9:11. When this famous discourse has reached the point when Krishna declares himself to be the one and only God, Arjuna asks him to show himself, to prove this lordship. What follows is then called a display of Krishna's mighty yoga, yoga Aishwaram, which culminates in the what is often called the vision of Krishna or the vision of Arjuna, but it's actually his mighty form, his form as a lord over nature. So this means he appears